From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, our foreign policy contributor weighs in on how the rest of the world views Russia as the Olympics go on.
Tolerance is one of the messages of the Olympics, and the, again, heavy-handed Russian persecution of gays, lesbians, but all kinds of different people who don't conform to a very rigid status quo. That's a source of embarrassment for the state.
Plus, the changing face of retirement. Author Sue Monk-Kidd taps real historical figures for her novel set in the 19th century. And with Valentine's Day approaching, we learn about romance biathlon style.
Actually, my first date with my now husband, we climbed up into the attic at the little cabin at the ski area, and we found the old biathlon targets from the 1980s, and we dug them out, cleaned them up, and then set them up again.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Nice to have you listening today. The top sports story in the world this week is also one of the top political stories. Russia is putting on the Winter Olympics in the Black Sea city of Sochi and is also putting itself on display to the world. Art Sear is our regular foreign policy contributor. He's Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, and he joins us with a look at Russia and the world. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice to be back with you, Mitch.
Well, let's start with what would be nice if it were merely a sports story. But the Olympics are underway, and they're going on in Russia, and President Putin has been a very visible attendee at those games. There was a lot of controversy leading up to the games. Russia's attitude towards gays and lesbians, threats of terrorism. Of course, it's still early in the games, but how are you viewing the Olympics right now from a foreign policy and a public policy standpoint? What's Russia's grade so far?
Well, Russia gets a very low grade in terms of preparation indirectly, and this point is not made often enough because I guess we take it for granted nowadays. In the 20th century, there are lots of totalitarian and dictatorial variations, alternatives to the market economy, not only communism, but forms of socialism and fascism and, of course, Nazism and others, militarism of all kinds in South America. But we really have reconfirmed the importance of market economies because no matter how dedicated people are and no matter how heavy-handed the state, and modern Russia is not that heavy-handed compared to these earlier dictatorships, you do need a market if anything complicated in the modern world is going to function. And indeed, the Kremlin is obviously embarrassed by the fact that there have been so many clumsy and awkward and crude missteps in the physical preparation for the Olympics, including restrooms that have no privacy between toilets and other things that are the function of a heavy-handed bureaucratic, still rather autocratic state.
Do you see Russia with a chance to redeem itself as the games go on? They're 2 weeks long. I think they run through the 23rd. And as is often the case, one might imagine that a lot of what went on leading up to the games might be forgotten if there are some really memorable moments in sports.
Absolutely. And you're right to mention the upside. Russia is a very large and diverse and talented nation and population. And historically, Russia and the Soviet Union, reflecting state support, but not just that, have done well in the Olympics. And obviously, Putin and associates are betting heavily that this will be the case ultimately, that athletic success will overshadow these terrible bureaucratic embarrassments.
Those issues, do they last beyond the Olympics? Or if things go pretty well over the next couple of weeks, are they forgotten when the games are over?
No, I don't think so. I think the things you mention are of considerable concern and very much stage center, if I may say, in Western countries. Tolerance is one of the messages of the Olympics, and the heavy-handed Russian persecution of gays, lesbians, but all kinds of different people who don't conform to a very rigid status quo. That's a source of embarrassment for the state, and it's interesting the way Putin doesn't defend Russian official behavior, but tries to sidestep the issue. But the message of the Olympics, whether it's this time around or the much more fearsome and fearful time, the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, designed to highlight the great talents of the new Nazi supermen and women in the Third Reich, That wound up being a serious embarrassment to Adolf Hitler personally. Jesse Owens, an African-American who happened to be a gifted athlete, he was the most dramatic example, but a very diverse athletic population from around the world scored a number of victories. The Germans won a lot, but they didn't achieve their purpose. A more germane example, because Russia is not the Third Reich, whatever its shortcomings and ugly sides, the 1988 Olympics was a way for South Korea to showcase national accomplishment. They're now a global leader, between number 12 and number 15 in global economies. As recently as a quarter of a century before the 88 Olympics, South Korea was one of the poorest nations on earth, just ahead of Burma, devastated by the Korean War. And I emphasize devastated, and still undergoing their own beginnings of an industrial revolution. I think that's a good example not only for Russia, but other states that aspire to international leadership. And the Korean Olympics, especially in hindsight, confirm the enduring importance of these games for all the right reasons.
And we should note that that South Korea hosts the next Winter Olympics 4 years from now.
Oh, yes, indeed. And a variety of international conferences and the Asia Games. The combination of international athletics and international trade, commerce, and finance, that seems to be an important dynamic that I'm still struggling to understand, but it's thoroughly positive.
How would you think Russia's policy towards the political unrest in Ukraine is likely impacted by the Winter Games? And how much is it likely to change after the Games are over?
That's a very good question. I don't think they're directly related. Putin, there's been a kind of tug of war between the European Union and Putin's Russia in terms of Ukraine's loyalty. Putin has been winning, but the government of President Viktor Yanukovych, I'm still struggling to learn a variety of new names in that part of the world, they've had to backpedal. These popular riots and protests have cost over a dozen lives. At least a couple of dozen people have been injured, and many are missing. The president has agreed to abandon his entire cabinet, including his prime minister, and he may well be forced from the scene soon. So it's a rather pyrrhic victory for Russia that the same kind of authoritarianism that Putin practices has been reflected in Ukraine. It shows, again, the forces pressing for openness are too significant to be stopped.
Russia has, of course, accused the United States and the West of trying to meddle in Ukraine's internal politics. Not surprisingly, the West probably is saying the same thing about Russia. Things were probably not helped by this leaked conversation between U.S. diplomats over the European Union's role. But how strong are the cards that the West might play in trying to execute a resolution of this crisis?
Well, the international trend, long-term and unstoppable, is toward freedom. Now, that's a rather abstract professor's point, but I do believe it's important. There is an awful lot of private capital in Ukraine. A still struggling economy would be badly hurt if it fled. Having said that, however, Putin has been extremely shrewd and extremely flexible in dealing with Europe, especially as well as, I believe, taking the initiative away from the United States in Europe and the Middle East and elsewhere. He has, over the long term, as have his predecessors, developed very important energy supply relationships with the European Union. There's a strong German-Russian partnership, however different Chancellor Merkel and President Putin may be in terms of personality and values. Germany and Russia are now cooperating very heavily in the energy field. And Russia, over time, I think in terms of natural resources, not commercial expertise, will exercise growing influence not only in Ukraine but in the rest of Europe.
From Ukraine, we go to a country that we think of as a generally more peaceful place. Voters in Switzerland have decided to roll back immigration levels and the rights of immigrants. Is this emblematic of a bigger trend across Europe?
No, I don't think so. Switzerland has always been distinctive. People think they're part of the European Union. They've had an associate membership since 1990, I believe, but they have always been very careful to maintain national independence. They've been fighting very hard, with some limited success, against transparency. The U.S. Treasury Department especially has been pressing them to provide records of very wealthy people, some of whom are on the lam from the law, who hide large amounts of money and other capital in Switzerland. The Swiss have been very reluctant to do this, but they are doing it. Likewise, the long-term trend is toward more open immigration. And Switzerland's distinctive role and their need to get along with the rest of Europe, but also the global financial system, I think means that they're not going to become totally isolated. But the Swiss people, historically, there's nothing new about this. They've, a polite way of putting it, they have shown a strong nationalism and strong aversion to foreigners. Maybe that's it, aversion to foreigners over a very long period of time. This is nothing new, even though Switzerland itself is a multicultural country with German, French, and Italian dimensions to not only the population but the language.
Finally, let's spend a couple of minutes on the ongoing crisis in Syria. There had been a ceasefire and talks that were going on. Neither one of those phenomena seems to have done the trick. The ceasefire didn't necessarily result in the putting down of weapons, and the peace talks have not really achieved their goal at this point.
Yes, I think the reality is the Assad regime is a very brutal regime. It's a very ruthless regime. I do believe they were guilty, and their military was guilty, of using poison gas on the population, an unusual event, even for all the ugly and violent side of wars in the world today, and rightly condemned. But it's a regime we're going to have to deal with for quite a while. This is not Libya. This is not other dictators in North Africa and other parts of the world who've fallen quickly. This is a very durable regime. President Obama, by making it clear that we would retaliate militarily if Syria crossed the red line of use of poison gas, and then reverting to rhetoric and, I believe, trying to point the finger at others, Russia and Europe and also the Congress, I think that greatly weakened our position in the region. Nonetheless, multilateralism is the only way to go. Syria cannot, which it does not produce oil or much of anything else outside of violence and repression, Syria cannot exist independently. And even their patron Russia, while anxious to continue end runs around the current administration in Washington, even Russia is committed to the multilateral process.
Art Zier, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Lake Effect News analyst Art Zier is Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. Revenge of the retirees, maybe that's too strong a way to put it, but one essayist believes there are some misconceptions about retirement that need to be cleared up in this day and age. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Retirement is a time for playing shuffleboard, deckside, moving to Arizona, and getting in a round of golf before taking advantage of the sunset special at the local diner. Well, that was once its reputation. Lake Effect essayist Carol Larson would take issue with that notion in 2014.
Hi, I'm Carol, and I'm retired. Now, without thinking, does your mind immediately picture someone ancient and befuddled, physically and mentally in decline? That's one of the ageist stereotypes applied to retirees. People worn out, dried up, and a burden on society. Just so you know, I'm an active 59 years old, work out 4 times a week, and I just finished writing my first book. Granted, I retired early, adding one more to the 8,000 baby boomers who, starting in 2011, retire every single day. People who, on average, will live 20 to 30 years past retirement age. But before you start wailing the economic sky is falling because of the burden we pose to the Social Security and Medicare systems, know this. Most retirees today are still healthy and probably will remain so for years. Another thing you should know about the new retirees, some of us are ticked off. Why? Because of the stubborn stereotype foisted on us, not only that we're old and decrepit, but worst of all, that when a person retires, we will never make another meaningful contribution to the world ever again. I mean, how could we? We're not working. Well, kids, welcome to the next revolution. Surveys over the last few years show most baby boomers have no intention to stop working. Oh, they're going to retire. Not crawling off to die or slotted into 30 years of forced leisure. They are retiring in order to live and work in the ways they want to. Why? Because baby boomers have always anchored their identities to their jobs and careers. What boomers do for work defines who they are. Just because we decide to collect our pensions doesn't change that. What it does change is the kind of work boomers intend to do. Baby boomers are, speaking in general terms, altruistic. They believe they can make the world a better place. Those surveys also show the work boomers want to do in retirement is often in education, healthcare, or social services, and they have set their collective sights on joining the nation's struggling nonprofits. Just a heads up there, folks, so get ready. Many boomers talk about working at least part-time because they have to supplement pensions and IRAs that shrunk in value during the recession. But it's also because they want to do something meaningful with the rest of their lives, to work for a cause, for personal satisfaction, for a purpose, to not just leave a legacy, but to live that legacy, leaving the world in better shape because of their contributions. Why do boomers think they can do that? Because they already have. Baby boomers were the demographic shove behind most social revolutions of the last decades, like civil rights, feminism, and the environmental movement. Historically, whenever baby boomers run into a barrier they don't like, they bust it down with the sheer force of their giant collective will. And the wall they are now running into is the social and professional barrier of retirement. Oh, pshaw, you say. There's nothing preventing a retiree from working or pursuing a new purpose in life. I thought that once, too. Was it just me? Why couldn't I get anywhere? All those unreturned phone calls and emails, the indulgent smiles from working people about my new hobbies. How nice for you. All that free time. Such wonderful, carefree life you must have. Call me sometime. We'll do lunch. I finally checked with older retirees and learned the ugly truth. There is an unspoken prejudice against those who have left the mainstream workforce. We're not taken seriously. Our dreams of new pursuits are considered a form of dementia. We're thought of as people who have to be taken care of, except for the services we provide in babysitting, volunteering, and sending gifts. Let me cue you into something. The baby boomers are not going to stand for being shrugged off into insignificance. It's not in our nature. Already, there are retired boomers starting new businesses, nonprofits, and service organizations, muscling their way into town boards, school committees, and into political action groups. Boomers see their retirements as a new phase of life when they can live and work on their own terms and as assets to their communities. These are people who already know what they're doing, who are storehouses of knowledge, and yes, even wisdom. So with that, here's another final revolutionary thought. With all the new retirees, all their experience and know-how, and their desire to make the world a better place, the retirement of the baby boomers might not be the cause of more problems in this world, they just might provide the solutions.
Now, an award-winning writer, Like Effect essayist Carol Larson is an alumnus of Milwaukee TV and Wisconsin Public Television. She retired in 2010 after a 33-year career in broadcast journalism. Another break now, and then author Sue Monk-Kidd chats about her newest novel, The Invention of Wings. It's Like Effect from WUWM. More of Like Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Sue Monk-Kidd's latest book is a novel, but it's based on the very real lives of sisters Sarah and Angelina Grimke, abolitionists and suffragists in the first half of the 19th century. Their story is little told outside of academic circles, but Kidd would argue that it's just as important and just as interesting. The Invention of Wings is based on fact, but it's mainly a fictionalized account of Sarah and the slave girl Hetty given to Sarah on her 11th birthday. The story follows the girls as they grow up and strive to become something larger than what society expected of them. Sue Monk-Kidd spoke to an audience at the Milwaukee Public Library's Centennial Hall last night. Beforehand, she sat down with Lake Effect's Bonnie North and explained how she came to learn of the Grimke sisters.
I think it's ironic that I lived in Charleston, South Carolina, where these two women were born, and I had to go to New York to discover them. I went to the Brooklyn Museum to see Judy Chicago's dinner party exhibit. And it was there on their heritage panels that I came upon the names of Sarah and Angelina listed among 999 women who have made these significant contributions to Western history, really. And I didn't know who they were. And then I discovered they were from Charleston, where I was then living. So I came home and I plunged into learning about their lives, and I was completely captivated by who they were and what they accomplished. And probably what moved me most was what they had to overcome to do what they did.
Exactly. It's a story certainly of them trying very hard and succeeding quite well in trying to abolish slavery, but also it's a story of women's suffrage.
It is. Actually, Sarah and Angelina were the first official female abolition agents in our country. And not only that, they became some of the earliest feminist thinkers in America. Sarah wrote one of the first comprehensive feminist manifestos, and very few people know about that. And her sister, Angelina, was a great orator, and she was the first woman to speak before a legislative body in this country. But the two of them carried on an enormous public crusade for both abolition and women's rights. And yet they aren't as known in the popular culture as, say, a Lucretia Mott or Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And I'm not sure why that is. I think they're well known in academics, probably in women's studies, women's history, and they might ring a vague bell in people's minds, but we don't seem to know them as readily. They're not as accessible to us in American history. So I hope maybe more people will discover them.
Me too, because I certainly thought I knew a lot about 19th century women's suffrage, more so than I knew about the abolitionist movement, although I know they dovetailed quite a lot. But I knew nothing about them. And I thought, oh, my goodness, here's this whole treasure trove of history. Which leads me to ask you why this became a novel rather than a biography.
Gerda Lerner wrote a wonderful biography of the Grimke sisters that I highly recommend people reading. But I'm not a biographer. I'm not a historian. I'm a novelist. And the moment that I read about their lives, the incredible conflicts that they dealt with, what they had to give up, I mean, what they lost, it affected me as, I think, as women who were struggling to overcome. And that's a story. I'm a novelist, so I wanted to write a good story about them, a really thickly imagined story. And so that was the challenge I had, was how to weave their history, which I revere, with this deeply imagined story of their lives.
And that's where Handful comes in as well, because she's imagined, right? She is someone out of whole cloth for you.
She's largely imagined. She is inspired by one small footnote in history, in Sarah's diary, actually, where Sarah talks about being given an enslaved girl at some point, probably when she was around 11 or 12 years old. And this enslaved girl was named Hetty. And we only know that Sarah taught her to read, and they were caught and punished for this because this was a crime in South Carolina to teach an enslaved person to read. And then we know from her diary that Hetty died very early, probably in her adolescence. So with that little piece of information, I knew this was the other half of the story, and I wanted to develop this character and her story to entwine with Sarah. So yes, that was all largely and, well, maybe totally imagined, yes.
She's a wonderful character, and they balance each other so well, which I am sure is your intent. But there's something about her, and also the city of Charleston itself is also a character, and how Hetty and Charleston work with each other and together, and how they experience each other. I found as I was reading the book that I've never been to Charleston, and I felt like I could smell it.
Well, that's wonderful to hear, because you want that sensuality in the story to affect all the reader's senses. So I want him to taste it and hear it and smell it too. But Charleston is a very sensual city, actually. It's a great city. In 1805-03, when these scenes were taking place and beginning in the story, you know, it was also a brutal place for enslaved people. And so I was trying to weave the story of Charleston into Hetty and Sarah's life, because it is a place of enormous gravity in their lives. I mean, you can't separate that. Urban slavery formed who they were.
And that is a story of slavery I think a lot of us don't know about. I mean, we think of plantations and we think of that kind of slavery, but the house slaves, the people who live in an urban place, the way you describe them having to get the passage to go out to go buy the food to bring back, that sort of thing. Again, that was one of those things that I didn't really know about.
Well, urban slavery is quite different on the outside than plantation slavery. Of course, inside, it has the same sort of brutality going on. But it only could operate on a system of surveillance and control. And that is what was going on in Charleston. I mean, the enslaved people were on the streets all the time, going about errands for their owners, carrying on business. They were often let out for hire, as they said. And there were curfews and badges and passes and permissions. And there was something called the workhouse. There was a city guard to keep things in place. So that's how it was able to function. So it does look differently than plantation slavery. And I don't think Americans, we're as familiar with urban slavery maybe in our books and movies as we are, you know, with plantation slavery.
As you were taking the facts of Sarah's life and turning it into the story that you wanted to tell, was it difficult to incorporate? Did you have to leave things out that you most wanted to keep in the story, but for whatever reason needed to remove them?
Well, as a novelist, my job is to serve that story. So, yes, you know, I had to leave things out, and I had to graft a lot of imagined scenes onto the truth. But I really think if you read The Invention of Wings, you will come away with a very good understanding of who Sarah Grimke was and what she accomplished, the kind of amazing feat she really did. And her turning points are in this book, the kind of internal process and angst and struggle that she went to, I wanted to portray. So there really is a lot of factual detail there, but that was important to me as a novelist, that she be represented.
The title, the invention of wings. Where did that story come from? Because it's a wonderful story.
Yes. I wish I could say that I had knew of that story before I came up with the title. So I don't know if it was brewing somewhere in the back of my mind that I, you know, heard of that story or knew of it from an earlier time and it was just a seed in there. But I'm one of these authors that likes to get my title first. It's an odd idiosyncrasy, really, and I don't recommend it. But I was coming up with all kinds of titles so I could have something to focus my story. And I came up with The Invention of Wings. And I thought, yes, that really captures it. And it was only later that I came upon this wonderful African-American folktale about people from Africa being enslaved, brought to this country, and losing their wings. And the story goes that in Africa they could fly, but when they came here they lost their wings and they had to rediscover their wings. And it's a tale of great hope, really. And so obviously I was delighted to find that story and began to weave it into my novel.
You talked about before about the slaves being hired out, and Handful's mother is one of those people in this book because she's such a skilled seamstress. She has such a talent with the needle that, you know, she's able to make money. She's able to actually save money. And quilting plays a very important role. So needlework and the idea of sort of stitching a life.
Yes, this is an important aspect in the story. I wanted to portray a way for enslaved women to tell their stories, not just the oral tradition, but in a way that they could preserve this and pass it down in a very concrete way. And I came upon the quilts of a real historical figure, Harriet Powers, who quilted these beautiful masterpieces, really, of art and narration. And there, one of them is hanging in, well, it's not hanging, it's archived in the Smithsonian. And I went there to see it. And the moment I laid my eyes on this, I thought, we have to have a quilt in the story. And it will tell the story of Handful's mother. And she will use this in an almost subversive way to record what happened to her and what it feels like and what it is like to be an enslaved woman. And she creates a visual memoir. And I think the quilting, the taking these pieces of our lives and stitching them together into a whole, into a meaning, it's healing. And it gives us a sense of our life mattering, our life being witnessed. And those are significant parts of the story.
For you, as you came to the end of the writing of the book, did you find yourself thinking about enslavement differently? Did you find yourself finding anything new in there for you as a white woman?
Well, I think the one thing that was shocking to me, very disturbing to me, is that slavery was even worse than I had imagined it. You know, we study this in school, in history, and then we have ideas about slavery from books we read, sometimes for good and sometimes not for good. But when I read the slave narratives, to hear the testimony coming from the mouth of enslaved people themselves, and I'm talking about 19th century slave narratives, and for instance, like Solomon Northrop's 12 Years a Slave, Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Woman, and there are hundreds of them. And then the testimony, the narratives of the 1930s that were preserved finally in an oral way. When I read these, it was as if I was seeing slavery for the first time, really, because it was so much more more terrible than I had even imagined. And, you know, someone said to me that they thought perhaps I had overstated the brutality of slavery in The Invention of Wings. And I thought, is this even possible? I mean, frankly, I couldn't even put all of it in there. It would be so raw for us to see. So that was one thing that my research revealed to me. But I think, too, as a white woman in the South, at that time, you know, they were vastly limited as well. It didn't compare to the subjugation of enslaved people, of course. But that was another shock for me, was just how limited, how few rights women really had and how small their world could be as well.
Yeah, I think that is something that a lot of people don't realize, that, you know, both the horror of enslavement, but also the horror of having that sort of cultural limitation as well. And you interweave the two really well. And as you say, it's not as horrible as being owned by another person. But there's a certain really it's awfulness about a mind like Sarah's, who wanted to be a lawyer, you know, who could have probably been a phenomenal lawyer if she had been allowed to do it, not being able to do that simply because of sex.
Yes, that's right. And so race and gender are huge motifs in this story. And they're important to me personally, that we look at the legacies that this time left us. Sarah, she had a brilliant mind and such a yearning to become, to have her life matter in the world. So, you know, it makes you ache for her, really, to see how she yearned for that and how she was crushed almost at every turn. So it seems perfect somehow that she would end up out there on the front lines in her life, later in her life, fighting for a woman's right to speak in the public sphere and to live a life outside the domestic sphere. And, you know, we owe a great debt to these women. And one thing I hoped that the invention of wings would accomplish was just to show us how far we have come and how far we still have to go.
Well, Sue Monk-Kidd, it has been such a pleasure having you. Thank you so much. The book is called The Invention of Wings, and we will have all the information on the website.
Well, thank you.
Sue Monk-Kidd's latest novel is called The Invention of Wings. She's also the award-winning author of The Secret Life of Bees and The Mermaid Chair. She spoke with Bonnie North before a Boswell Books event at Centennial Hall yesterday. You can hear her read two sections of the book, one in Sarah's voice and one in Hetty's, at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then everything you ever wanted to know about the Olympic sport of biathlon. Starting with what skiing and shooting have to do with each other. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. A lot of us are watching the Winter Olympics and spending some time with sports we don't see very often. Some of them are pretty easy to appreciate. Ski jumpers go off a ramp and try to fly as far as they can. Bobsledders go down an icy track and go as fast as they can. But some sports seem to require an additional explanation. There are 11 separate events in Olympic biathlon, the sport that involves cross-country skiing and target shooting. Two disciplines whose connection is not immediately obvious. Also, sometimes the shooters are lying down, sometimes they're standing up. There are a lot of things that seem like question marks about biathlon. And while we could have just looked up the answers, this is a radio show, so we went one better and reached out to a former Olympic biathlete. Minnesota's Carolyn Bramante competed in the 2006 Winter Games in Torino. She joins us on the phone this morning. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let me ask you the question that probably everyone who only sees biathlon every 4 years probably wonders. What do cross-country skiing and target shooting have to do with each other? Or is the point that they don't ostensibly have anything to do with each other?
Well, there is a big history of people skiing and hunting and defending themselves on skis. So there are cave paintings in Norway from over 1,000 years ago of people hunting on skis. There were soldiers on skis as recently as World War II. So there is sort of a rich history in the very usefulness of biathlon.
But I would imagine there are not a lot of modern athletes who come to the sport with expertise in both areas.
Right. Most people come to the sport from a skiing background. Lanny Barnes, who is one of the current Olympians, came from a shooting background. She was shooting from age 2 or something, and then started skiing in around 13 or 14. But most people come at it from being a cross-country skier first, and then they learn how to shoot.
And so how did you find, and how does a cross-country skier typically find their way to a sport like biathlon? I imagine it's not like hockey. There aren't a lot of peewee biathlon leagues out there or pickup biathlon taking place. How do you find yourself in that realm?
Yeah, so I came to the sport because I grew up in northern Minnesota, and I started skiing, and my high school ski coach said, hey, you should try biathlon. And yeah, there aren't clubs all over the country. They are kind of centered in places who reliably have a lot of snow, and Minnesota just happened to be one of those places. So I was lucky that I could go to a recruiting camp and meet the junior national team and their coaches, and then kind of went from there.
Given that there are not a lot of places with reliably that much snow, I would imagine that the centers of the biathlon universe in this country are places like northern Minnesota and from what I gather, northern Maine as well. Is that right?
Yes, northern Minnesota, Maine, Alaska, Vermont, Lake Placid, and then there is a little bit out west. Utah has been a common training location in the past. So, yeah, basically just a few places around the country where there's reliable snow.
Well, and given that there are so relatively few places, if you find yourself in a developmental situation, do you have fairly good access to the who's who of the biathlon world as you're making your way?
Yeah, no, it is. It's definitely tricky. It's tricky to combine biathlon and going to college because there aren't that many places where you can do biathlon and where there's a college or a couple of college options. But it's sort of become a sport where you do it either pretty seriously and you kind of move where the training opportunities are if you do want to make this a prime focus of your life.
Well, and I gather you went to Dartmouth, is that right?
Yeah, I went to Dartmouth, and I did that when not many people on the team were going to college, but I knew that I could try to do biathlon at Dartmouth because, well, there's a great ski team there with great cross-country ski training, but then there also is a biathlon range, kind of a makeshift range near the campus. Actually, my first date with my now husband, who I met at Dartmouth, we climbed up into the attic at the little cabin at the ski area, and we found the old biathlon targets from the 1980s, and we dug them out, cleaned them up, and then set them up again.
How romantic.
I know. It worked. So.
Well, let's go back to the sport of biathlon itself. And, you know, a couple of questions probably become extremely apparent to anybody that watches the sport. And one of them is this idea that, you know, you're skiing and you're skiing hard, and then you have to be able to stop and shoot very accurately. What is the secret to being able to steady yourself enough to shoot a target after you've been expending all that energy on your skiing?
Yeah, it's really difficult, actually. In order to ski and shoot, you have to be really fit so that your lactic acid level isn't too high while you're trying to shoot. And then you also just have to work on the timing with your shooting so that you're shooting at the end, in a specific sequence with your breathing pattern. So there's no major secret. You're not directly affecting your heart rate, but you just have to be very fit. You have to have immediate relaxation techniques and then really have good timing with shooting.
Is there a certain conserving of energy you do ahead of the target shooting and before the final sprint?
Yes, that's very true. You pace throughout the race. You don't go as hard on the first lap generally as you do on the last lap because the quicker your lactic acid builds up in general, the harder it is to shoot. But then biathletes who are racing at really elite levels do train such that they are able to race at almost 100% effort for an entire race. But there's always an extra sprint effort in the last lap.
And if I understand biathlon correctly, there are actually two styles of shooting that you have to do in a race. There's the part where you're lying down on your belly and shooting, and then there's a standing shooting sequence as well?
Yes, and they make it hard because the lying down part is always first in the race, and then the standing up part is always the last shooting position in the race. So when your legs are most tired with the highest lactic acid, that's when you have to stand and shoot.
And probably that's the point where you wish you could be lying down.
And exactly. That's when you want to lie down.
Tell us about the guns that biathletes use. These look a fair sight different than maybe the typical guns that a Wisconsinite would use to go deer hunting.
Yes. I am not a hunter myself, so I'm not sure about what Wisconsiners do for deer hunting. It's probably not as good as what people in Minnesota do for deer hunting.
Of course not.
But the guns for biathlon are 22 caliber rifles, 22 long. So the rifle itself is custom made for the biathlete. Usually when you're first starting out in the sport, you buy a rifle, and the most common brand is by Anschutz, Germany. And the stock that comes with the rifle is adjustable in a million different places, so you can get it custom fit for your body and your shooting stance. And then as you go along in the sport, most biathletes will have a stock custom made for them. So where a stock maker would measure out various measurements on your body and then make one from scratch just for you. I had this done from someone in the Czech Republic, and it's just a beautiful piece of wood and artwork as well as a useful shooting tool. And then the biathlon teams always travel with a spare rifle, and they have that at the shooting range during a race in case a competitor falls and they break their rifle or something like that, and then they would finish the race with the team's spare rifle.
How common is that?
Thankfully, not very common, but it does happen, so the spare rifle is there at every single race.
And from watching the sport, do I gather that the trigger is modified in a way to make it easier to shoot?
Oh, good question. Yes, you are able to adjust the trigger weight and then the initial phase of the trigger. So how there's one phase, and then the final phase is when you press and the trigger actually fires. All of the triggers are tested before every single race, and they have to support 500 grams for the rifle to be considered a legal trigger weight.
You know, when you watch the sport on TV, you see the person shooting, and sometimes you see a close-up of the target, but what we don't really have a perspective on is how far away the target is and how large it is that you're shooting at.
Yes, the target is about 50 meters away, and the targets are 4.5 centimeters for the prone and I think about 11 centimeters for standing.
Neither one of these is a particularly huge target.
No, it's pretty small. It's like a silver dollar for prone and then the size of a very small saucer for standing. And it's 50 meters in the wind and the snow and with a heart rate of 190.
And I gather one of the ways that athletes are able to concentrate on the target is they have kind of blinders mounted on the rifle as well?
Yes, you typically put a blinder in front of your non-shooting eye so that the two eyes don't compete with focusing the target. And then some athletes will also put a blinder on the other side of their shooting eye to block wind from affecting their eye.
As you told us, the skiing came first for you. What was it that appealed to you about the whole package?
You know, I went to the training camp not knowing if I was going to be shooting BB guns or bows and arrows or anything. And then I just enjoyed the challenge of trying to shoot the targets, and the people were really wonderful. And I just really liked that sort of intellectual aspect that shooting added to skiing.
Is there any opportunity for a retired Olympic biathlete to practice her craft?
Yeah, I typically give a little workshop every March in Minnesota. And there's a growing biathlon club in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown. And, you know, I go out for fun. I do a lot of roller skiing and skiing still, but I don't have my rifle out here in Baltimore with me.
Probably not a lot of cause for a rifle, especially one that you mount on your back and go skiing with in Baltimore.
Exactly. Hopefully not. Yeah.
They might look at you sideways in the Inner Harbor anyway.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's plenty of venues in Minnesota, and, I mean, it is really fun, so I don't get to do it as often as I would like to.
Do you feel like, given how relatively small the biathlon community is, given the success that you've had in the sport, is it incumbent on people like you to give back to the sport itself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you're able to give back, it's great for the growth of the sport if you can, and for your own enjoyment. So, and we do really need to develop the sport and get more numbers involved. So I try to do some teaching with young kids in Minnesota every year, and then I'm the alternate rep for U.S. Biathlon to the U.S. Olympic Committee's Athlete Advisory Board. So when the representative couldn't make it, I went to a meeting in January. And, yeah, I think whenever someone finds a way to give back to something they think is important, it's rewarding for them.
As an American biathlete, it must be something of an eye-opener to go to other countries where this is a much bigger spectator sport and see the kind of climate for biathlon in other places.
Oh, my gosh, it's incredible. Yeah, I've been surrounded for my autograph before, and I've never won. Well, I've won a couple of medals internationally, but nothing on the World Cup level. And then at the Olympics, I signed someone's jacket, and then a year later at World Championships, that same guy kind of flagged me down on the side of the ski trail and showed me his jacket, and there was my signature. You know, people really get into it, whereas, you know, it's just not very popular here in the U.S. At races in Europe, there will be 40,000 people in the stadium, and then people 3 to 8 wide all around the ski course cheering you on, and it's just a much different experience.
In contrast, if you tell someone in this country that you are a biathlete, what's the reaction that you usually get?
I usually automatically explain what the sport is, just assuming people don't know. But more and more often recently, people have actually heard of it.
All right. Well, Carolyn Bramante, thank you so much for spending some time with us and explaining more about the really intriguing sport of biathlon.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Carolyn Bramante competed in the 7.5-kilometer sprint and the women's 4x6-kilometer relay in biathlon in the 2006 Winter Games in Torino. She's originally from Duluth, Minnesota, but is now a resident in internal medicine and pediatrics at Johns Hopkins University Hospital in Baltimore. There is a Wisconsin biathlon program, by the way. You can learn about the Wisconsin Biathlon Cup happening this weekend in Eagle from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And because it is pretty tricky, no, let's say it is impossible to find an English language song about biathlon, taking us out today in German is Keller Steff und Band and Der Biathlon Song.
Weltmeister, Weltmeister, wer wär's wären, steht in die Stirn. Weltmeister, Weltmeister.
That's all for Tuesday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure do hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.